Everybody, my name's Anna Healy-Fenton. I'm the president of the club. You're very welcome here today. Quick housekeeping. On Thursday, we've got Tony Tyler, who's leaving Cathay Pacific to go and work for IATA in Geneva. I think that's a sellout already, but we do have some extra capacity downstairs in the bunker if anybody still really wants to come along. That's this Thursday, St. Patrick's Day, the day after tomorrow. We also have St. Patrick's Night Dinner. Gosh, this is very difficult to find the right place. St. Patrick's Night Dinner on Thursday as well. I think there's still some places on that if anybody wants to come along. Now, today we have a wonderful lady from Shanghai called Mina Hanbury Tennyson. She's written a very humorous, tongue-in-cheek look at Shanghai ladies and their approach to marrying their way up the social ladder and staying there. And I think, although she herself says she's Korean, she says she's learned a lot, and I think we're all waiting to hear what tips she has for us. So, Mina, over to you.
Thank you very much. I'm really honored to be here. So if you, any of you know Shanghai ladies, you know that you'll get nothing for free. So there's no way you'll learn anything about the book today from the talk. You'll have to buy it. Before I start, I sort of wrote the outline for the talk before the earthquake and the tsunami in Japan. And I just really want to preface the talk, which is supposed to be tongue-in-cheek. And it seems a little bit inappropriate in retrospect, by saying that no wisdom, whether Shanghai or Chinese or American, will save us when nature decides to strike. So I just want to convey my regrets to the people in Japan. So with that, I'll start. People have been asking me about myself, which is kind of interesting. They say, well, are you Shanghainese? And I say, no, I'm not. And they say, well, are you Chinese? And I say, no, I'm not. I'm actually Korean. And that's very confusing for them. And they say, well, why do you have this name, Mina Hanbury Tennyson? And I say, well, it's because I married somebody named Hanbury Tennyson, so therefore it's sort of my name. And the reason it's sort of my name is actually I go by name Mina Choi, which is my Korean name. And in China, they call me Choi Mina. And of course, in Korean, that is Choi Mina. So that is my original Korean name. And I've adapted this Hanbury Tennyson name, not because I really wanted to, but because after I married my husband in 1997, I kept getting mail from my in-laws. And my in-laws are such that they always address the letter in a very specific way. And it always said, Mrs. William Hanbury Tennyson. And I married him in 1997, and he was living in Shanghai at the time, so I'd moved to Shanghai. And you don't know what a nightmare it was to get a piece of mail addressed Mrs. William Hanbury Tennyson, because I look like this, and I would show up at the very primitive Chinese post office with this document saying, Mrs. William Hanbury Tennyson, there's a parcel waiting for you, all in kind of wonky English. And I would say, excuse me, there's a parcel waiting for me. And could you give it to me? And then my passport would say, Mina Choi. And they said, excuse me, you are not Mrs. William Hanbury Tennyson. And so I would say, yes, I am. I am Mrs. William Hanbury Tennyson. It's the same person. It says Mina Choi. And they said, nope, you're not. I'm not giving you the parcel. So I got to the point where I would send my husband to pick up the parcel. And I said, look, if they can't write to me saying Mina Choi or whatever that the post office will sort of hand over the package, whichever name that works, then you have to pick it up. But of course he was working at the time and I wasn't, so he didn't. So what I finally did was I got my name card printed and it said Mina Tennyson with the address. And so I would go to the post office with my passport, which said Mina Choi, and I would say, excuse me, a package has arrived. I've gotten yet another notice for Mrs. William Hanbury Tennyson. Could you give it to me? And they would look at the passport and they would say, no, because you're not William Hanbury Tennyson or Mrs., you are Mina Choi. And then I would slip up my name card, which said Mina Tennyson. And I said, look at the address. I am Mina Choi. the name card says Mina Tennyson. We live at the same address. I am the missus. And they'll say, okay, here's the package. And they, of course, in 1997, service level in China was very crude. So they would sort of kick you the package, sort of grunt. And then I would finally get my package. So I was very happy. So that's how the name came about. So my friends in America know me as Mina Choi. So that's one clarification that I would like to mention. So the reason I wrote this book is because when I moved to Shanghai in 1997, I actually didn't know anything about China or Shanghai. Actually, I actually moved in 1996 because I got engaged in 1996. And I am children of Korean immigrants who moved to the US. And lucky for them, they immigrated just before the Gwangju massacre, okay, which still the Korean government has not fully acknowledged, I believe. So we were fleeing, and in fact, my parents are North Koreans, so they had been fleeing the whole time, and they had moved to America, and they decided that they would become Americans and pursue the American dream. So therefore they did everything right, sort of the Amy Chua Tiger Mother, you know, SAT scores, you must get perfect score, otherwise you're nothing, that kind of thing. And it sort of worked to a period. I managed to get myself into Yale University. And recently, after I published this book, some friends of mine from Shanghai ladies came up to me and they said, I had no idea you were so smart. Because they had no idea, anyway, period. So I said, oh really, what makes you think I'm smart? And they said, well, it says in the book, you graduated from Yale University with a degree in literature. And I said, yes, that's true. But you knew me 10 years ago and nothing's changed. And they said, well, but what did you read as a literature major? And I said, well, actually, this is the dirty little secret. It's like when you major in literature, you don't read anything. If you want to read something, you major in English. But literature majors are people who write things about things they know nothing about. And they write long, lengthy theses and go on and on and on. So that was me. So I said, well, it's sort of hard to explain to Shanghai ladies that. So I just say, well, you know, I just, that was my major. Back to the point of being in Shanghai. In 1997, I sort of landed in Shanghai and I had no idea what Shanghai was. I sort of understood what it was from sort of Hollywood, because I had worked in Hollywood for 4 years. I knew that it was kind of, to be Shanghai'd was not a good thing. And then once I arrived, I would meet some people and they would say, oh, watch out for those Shanghai ladies. Or they would lean over to my husband and say, oh, you got married, who did you marry? And they would say this right in front of me, and he would say, oh, she's American, she's Korean. It's like, oh, thank God you didn't marry one of those Shanghai ladies. So there was this kind of idea of the Shanghai girl being this kind of formidable, something that you have to watch out for. And it was sort of, it was kind of a popular idea as well. When I arrived in Shanghai, I realized actually Shanghai ladies were quite different. First of all, this was 1997. So you have to remember the Shanghai you know, for those of you who travel, is not what it was back then. I mean, I would say an average white collar worker in 1997 made about 800 renminbi. And that was considered a good salary. A construction worker made 300 renminbi. I mean, that's $45, right? US, or you know, right now that's about, what, 260 Hong Kong dollars? So most people's means were very, very limited. My husband at the time was the Jardine's representative for East Asia, and he had a Mercedes-Benz and a driver. And he was also head of Jardine Fleming, so he also had a Lexus and a driver. So I got to use it whenever I wanted. So I was actually in my 20s, and I was living really at a standard that I was never used to, for sure. But definitely that a lot of the people in my age group didn't have at the time. And back then, Shanghai only had two hotels. One was the Shangri-La Ritz-Carlton, which is now one of the Shangri-La Portman, which is now called Ritz-Carlton Portman. It was the Shanghai center built by the Americans, right opposite, of course, the Russian-built exhibition center. And that was sort of the only five-star hotel. And, you know, there were a handful of expats there, and we all knew each other, and we all had chauffeured cars. So that there was a whole sort of existence hovering in, at this kind of level that the locals didn't have. And at the same time, the ladies that I would see were extremely well turned out, dressed much better than I was. And, the, you know, and they would walk up and down the main drag, which is still the main drag, Huaihai Road, you know, looking fantastic, arm in arm with their mothers or their with their mother or their girlfriends, looking fantastic. And during that period, I met my friend Lan Lan. And Lan Lan was actually just a few years older than me, but she was Shanghainese, and she was local. She was running a business. And she, too, enjoyed the same lifestyle that I enjoyed. And mind you, I enjoyed that lifestyle very, very briefly for about 16 months before the Asian financial crisis and my husband got laid off. The cars were gone, the chauffeurs were gone, and the great housing subsidy, you know, that in the, at that time, to rent an apartment in Shanghai, a decent apartment was $10,000 a month, very similar to probably what you're seeing in Hong Kong or probably slightly less. And whereas the locals were sharing, you know, they had an allocation of 4 square meters a head with shared bathrooms. And if you've ever seen these shared bathrooms, you know, 15, 14 years ago, you would know that they are not the bathrooms that most women would like to frequent. Okay, so, I mean, so, and, you know, even having a bath under these conditions were very difficult. So it was, I mean, the difference between the existence I had and the locals was very great. And also, the other thing was Shanghai was just beginning to wake up and emerge. So in 1997, they had only one subway line. Can you imagine that? Just one. It had just gone up in. And, you know, I took it. And my Shanghai friends couldn't figure out why I would take it. They said, you have two cars. Why would you take the subway? And I said, well, I'm a big fan. I grew up in New York. I'm a big fan of public transportation, which is why I love Hong Kong, because you can take the tram, the ferry, the metro, and you can get to places very, very fast. So I said, I would take it. And then, of course, the Chinese thing is that they want to make you feel good about it or flatter you. So she would say, oh, you really understand that system very well, the subway system. And I said, darling, it's only one line. You know, you can't really get on the wrong line. Now you know, if anyone's been there, there are about 17 lines intersecting that take you everywhere. So it was a very, very different time. The first elevated highway just went up. It was under construction. Everything was just local streets. So that it was just a city in transition. And in the meanwhile, Lan Lan, who was just a few years older than me, was frequenting all the top restaurants. Well, all of them, which you could count on your two hands, and, you know, really spending at a level that was beyond even my means. You know, she would say, "Oh, come to the Ritz-Carlton." I mean, not Ritz-Carlton, the Shangri-La, and I'll treat you for tea. And tea, you know, at that time was really almost the same as it is now. But for locals, that was their entire month's salary. So I was just very, very fascinated by this woman and how she got to be where she was. And she started telling me stories about herself and her girlfriends. And this book is kind of a story of our friendship, really. In a strange way. So I collected all these stories. And the other thing that was true about the Shanghai Center was that it had a very, very exclusive health club. And I couldn't afford it. It was very expensive. So I would go in as a guest member. But there was also, when I would go in to use this health club, I would see a group of ladies who were also in their 20s or 30s who were members. And the membership at the Shanghai Center Health Club / Shangri-La was something like, at that time, I would say, how much was it? About 30,000 RMB a year. So you can imagine. I mean, you have people spending, you know, making 300 to 800 RMB a month. And there were these ladies who were basically a member at a club that was nearly 30,000 renminbi a year. So I was just fascinated. So she started telling me who they were. I would say, well, I mean, how is she here? How can she afford this? You know, who is she? Does she have a rich daddy? Of course, this is, you know, China, so there are no rich daddies, right? So then she would say, well, so and so and so. So actually, after about, you know, I accumulated all these locker room stories one by one, and then I thought I'd really like to share them because they were so, first of all, Shanghai women are very unsentimental, which is in the book, about what they want to do and what they need to have, and they were very goal-focused, and that's what she basically conveyed to me very strongly. So I said, well, how do I take these stories and put them in a book? So I thought about it, and about 6 years ago, I talked to a few people, and they said, well, just write an outline. So I wrote an outline, but as I wrote the outline, I thought, it's really not very interesting, because the stories are the same. This girl comes out of nowhere, finds an opportunity, and oftentimes it happens to be a guy, and is really rich now, or doing really well. So in fact, it was kind of monotonous, the stories over and over again. So I thought, well, how do I turn them into something interesting? So I really sort of pulled back, and I thought, actually, in this very, very strange way, I think Lan Lan became kind of a mentor, because she really introduced me to China and to Shanghai, and showed me why the mentality there is different, and what is there to enjoy. And so I thought, I will write it as a how-to book. I'm a big fan of how-to books. I was just telling Anna that if there's a how-to book, no matter how silly or stupid, I always read it. It's like my, you know, it's my vice, and I'll always pick it up, and I'll buy it, you know, above all literary books. So I thought, well, wouldn't it be fun to write it as a how-to book? So that's how the book came to be in its current form. And I really see the book as kind of a seduction, because I think Lan Lan was so seductive. And there was a period when I really felt like, you know, after my, well, there was a period where I just thought, why am I not in traveling first class? And why am I not buying these Louis Vuitton bags? And why am I not, you know, why I'm, and then I thought, well, actually the truth is, I'm really not like her in some ways. But there's kind of a seduction. She was extremely charming, and she still is, extremely seductive. And I thought, in a way, she really seduced me. And I really, you know, and I still value her friendship. We're very good friends. But I realized there are certain things that I cannot do, so I cannot be seduced the whole way. So I think I structured the book sort of like Lan Lan's seduction. Anyway, so that's all. And if people have any questions, I'm happy to answer. Should I sit down? Well, I'll just stand up, it's fine.
The first question here. How do you elegantly move from the first marriage to the second one? That seemed to me like a very difficult maneuver.
Well, it's in the book.
Can you just tell us?
Well, according to Lan Lan, well, actually, you know what? I let me pull back. That's a very good question. I think I've been really criticized for this book, and people have come to me and said, this gives China a bad name, this guy gives Shanghai women a bad name, and how can you write such trash? When I had a book opening, this guy said, you know, these people are morally bankrupt, okay? So I understand there are some provocative elements in this book, but the one thing about Shanghai women that I do know is that they are very goal-focused, very money-oriented, very very smart and upwardly mobile, but they're actually very loyal. So that's a very strange answer to your question, but. I had a conversation with a very brilliant Shanghai-based writer who writes in English, and she's sort of the grand dame of Shanghai. And I sort of said, she said, "Oh, Mina, what are you working on?" And I told her about this book. And she said, she listened, and sort of the sign of contempt was sort of showing in her face. And I thought, oh dear, this is not good. And she said, "You know, Mina, you say that these girls married up, But in fact, they married down. It's just that their economic circumstances made it seem like they were worth nothing. But they were, in fact, smarter, from better families, better educated, and better grade of people than these husbands. So I thought, oh, well, that's an interesting way of looking at it. And she said, and the thing about Shanghai women that I do know is they're very loyal to their families. So I don't go into it in the book because it's kind of mawkish and sentimental. And the other thing about Lana is she's never be sentimental, is that once they are married and they have children, they really do their best to stick around. They do. And so I always say that if the Shanghai girl leaves you and she has your children, then you have to be a serious loser. Serious loser, because this is what this writer said. She said, now that Shanghai is back on its feet, right? These women are very wealthy and they're keeping their husbands. And it's true, they're keeping their husbands, but the only difference is that there's a whole thing about giving face to the husband so that they never show that they're keeping their husbands. It's sort of like, the only reference I can think about is Barbara Streisand in is that Funny Girl, you know, when she has sort of made it and her husband's in decline and she comes up with a business opportunity for him that she's basically paying for, so that he can feel good about himself. And actually, that is true about a lot of the Shanghai women I do know. But that doesn't really answer your question, how you make a smooth transition to the second marriage. But you have to read a book for that.
OK. Can you introduce yourself, please, before you ask a question?
Down there? Hello, Bonnie Engel, Asian Art Newspaper and Art Writing. Why do you think Shanghai girls are worthy of a topic rather than Beijing girls or Guangdong girls or Xi'an girls or something else? Is there something about Shanghai and its history that makes them unique?
Well, that's a very good question. Shanghai is very, very different. Shanghai is very different because it's actually a city run by women, but they just give face to the men. So if you've actually been to Shanghai and had lunch at the most expensive places, what you'll see is that it's a city dictated by groups of women who look great, and they trade investment tips, and they know exactly what to do with the money, especially the husband's money, and they know how to make the husband richer, and it's just I think it's actually kind of a matriarchal city. It's kind of a strange thing to say, but it's true. I think it is true. And you'll see that the power couple in Shanghai is the mother and the daughter on Huaihai Road or Nanjing Road. And the daughter is dressed in high heels or boots and the latest, you know, sort of sassy outfit. And, you know, if I dressed like that, my mother would have killed me. She would have said, you cannot go out. But actually, what you'll see her is a mother who only looks about 10 years older than her, looking also wearing the high heels. And then they will be talking about, what does he have? And I overhear these conversations. They'll be like, what's his taojian? You know, does he have, oh, he's got a house, that's not bad. But the house has a mortgage, how much? You know, and it's just like, And when I gave a talk, this mainland guy, and he was a Yale Law School grad, very powerful, and he stood up. He's from Beijing. Oh, no, I think he might be from Zhejiang. I can't remember. But he stood up and he said, you know what? For all the mainland men, they know that having a Shanghai woman is a real prize because they know how to look after their children, their family. They know how to invest the money as long as you can afford to have a Shanghai wife. Right, so it's like, as far as he was concerned, it was the best kind of trophy wife you could have in China, Shanghai girl. It's like he said, if you're showing up with a Shanghai wife, that's like saying to all your classmates and everyone you know in the business community, I've made it. Because there's no way she's going to be with me if I haven't.
Okay, next question. Where else? Where are we going?
I Hi, this is Vicky Wong. I know the Minas when she was in Shanghai, and then apart from her writing career for Shanghai Girl, I think that she have her for also another aspect of writing is from a freelance writer for the Financial Times, interviewing. So I think it is about, I want to address to Mina, what is your future direction? Because Shanghai Girls is really a leisure piece of you. So then you, just for the other ladies just mentioned, do you write about the Beijing Girls, Tianjin Girls, or you go to another? Because sometimes people, writers are very obsessed by the first book. That is you are in for Shanghai Girl. Maybe this is too absorbed by Shanghai scenario. Will you take yourself out to write about Hong Kong Girls, or, well, example like a Shanghai Man? Or the other thing is well, also I think you have talent also to write on the business angles as well.
Right. I mean, there is temptation to franchise it. No, but really, I mean, I can write about Shanghai because I live there and I have Shanghai ladies, but I mean, can I really write about Moscow girls? No. I mean, but you know, I think I lived in Los Angeles for a long time. So the idea, you know, there's a section in the book where they talk about being unsentimental, and that means sometimes you're going to be dating guys much older, or even marrying guys much older. But I also was in Los Angeles, worked in Hollywood, you know? And, you know, Hollywood is full of very ambitious young ladies who will do anything to get their role, you know, in a movie or in a television show or in a reality show. And so I worked with these women and I was often mistaken for one, God knows why, because I guess, you know, I was in my 20s and I wore miniskirts. I don't really do that anymore because I'm married. But once I showed up in Los Angeles and my father was visiting, so I took him to my favorite restaurant and the valet parker guy said, "Mina, you have a new boyfriend." And I was like, "Oh, this is my father, you know?" And he said, "Oh, sorry." And so he sort of disappeared and I was so embarrassed because I thought, "Oh God, I hope my father doesn't think I'm dating guys who are his age, you know?" But, you know, this is like an LA scene. So, like, the idea of, like, for a lot of these Shanghai women, that they're happy to marry somebody 25, 30 years older is not new. I think what's different about Shanghai women, and I think this is why, I think, to answer Bonnie's question again, is that I think they really enjoy the friendship of women. They know where the power center is. So, in the U.S., when you have these fantastic-looking women or just very sassy women who can get, you know, anybody they want, they don't actually really have girlfriends. But Shanghai women do, and they trade tips. I'm still going to spa with them. And, you know, it's like, oh, how do you get this done? And hair tips, and this one, you know, your hair can look like 3,000 RMB, but you can do it for 20 here. Let me give you the tip. Oh, here's where you can get the silk thing made. And, oh, you must eat the eel now because it's in season. And here it's only 300 RMB, which seems like a lot to me. I'm like, you know, for eel in a wonton soup, that sounds like really like a lot, but for them, they know that it's in season, it's good, and these kind of tips are traded. The only thing I have noticed with these women is that when they think that you are taking the man away, then you're dead. That's the only thing. It's like, just steer clear of my man and you're okay. So it's like, you know, it's like they're 100% your friend, absolutely, until they get wind that there's something going on, and then you're the enemy. Which is also in the book.
Okay. Any more questions?
Yes.
Hang on a sec, the microphone's coming.
Apparently this is being recorded, which makes me very nervous, but that means you're being recorded too.
Elizabeth Atwood, ACP Magazines. Could I ask two questions? Firstly, is Lan Lan still your friend after she's read the book? And what does she think of the book? And were you surprised or did you anticipate the controversy the book would cause?
To answer your first question, Lan Lan is still my friend. She hasn't read the book. I sent it to her and I said, "Lan Lan," and obviously it's not her real name. She said, "Please call me Lan Lan." And I said, "Sure." And I said, but how do I do it when they want your signature? They're like, oh, just fake it, you know. So I said, Lennon, do you want to read the book? She's like, send it to me. And then she never read it, or I don't know. She never got back to me. And I said, Lennon, what do I say? What do I say when people accuse me? Like, what do you as a Korean or Korean American or whoever you are, know about Shanghai women? What do I say, you know? I mean, like, it's kind of difficult. I wish you were there to defend me. And she said, who cares? She said, who cares? She said, I've told you everything. You've learned it from the best. Even the book is 30% correct. It means true. 30% of the time, that's good enough. So that's Lanlan. You know, it doesn't affect her because she's so busy. She's so busy making money. And the second question was,
were you surprised at the controversy?
No, I wasn't, because the book was turned down so many times. The book was turned down so many times, and like I would tell people about the title, and they would sort of, like, you know, look at me with a show of contempt. So I wasn't at all. I mean, based on, people have said, why are you Mina Hambury Tennyson? And I will tell you the story about my name, is that I initially wrote the book and I pitched it as Mina Choi, and with Lan Lan. And my editor, my agent came back to me and said, well, actually, we would like a Western name. They don't realize there's somebody who can speak English, who can sort of talk up this book. So can you sort of do a Western name? And I said, okay, then just use my, you know, married name, Mina Hambury Tennyson. They said, oh, okay, sure. And then when the book was about to be published, so it was already, you know, sort of at the printer, people came to me and they said, actually, now they think it's too controversial. They think you're an English woman, and you're like talking out of turn. So can we change your name again? And I was like, okay, just call me Mina Choi again. That's fine. They're like, no, can we call you Mina Choi Tennyson? And I was like, no, you can't call me that. And they said, well, why not? Because it's like, that's not a name. You know, even Mina Hambury Tennyson is not a real name, but you can't call me Mina Choi Tennyson. Besides, my husband will be furious. So then that's how the book ended up being what it was.
Okay, let's have two more questions.
Yes, over there.
Oh, over there?
Yes.
Over there.
Hi, my name is George Long. I run a hedge fund here. I'm not married to a Shanghai woman, so I don't have any personal experience. So I have to ask you this question. You talked about how the women are very seductive, and so my question is this, and I hope it's not too explicit, but are the women highly seductive, physical, until they're married? And then once they're married, the men say, whoa, what was that? A woman says, shut up, I'm off with my girlfriends, no sex tonight. I mean, is it a black and white sort of transformation that happens to these women after they get married, or do they remain seductive and physical and passionate?
You know, first of all, thank you for the question. Is that the other thing about Shanghai women are they're very secretive, and so they don't tell me a lot of these things. I mean, I think what I gathered, and I think you have to appreciate the book as such, is kind of locker room talk. Like when guys talk in the locker room about women, they're not telling you everything. They're not telling you about whatever. Okay, I won't go into that, but they're not telling you about the ugliness or the time they didn't perform or any of that. They're just like being jocular and they're showing off. And in a way, Shanghai women are also like that. They're very face oriented. So, you know, they will only tell you the good things. They will only talk about their triumphs and their success. They'll never talk about the days that down or, you know, when they find out that their husband's cheating on them. They will never do it. They will only tell you after the problem's been resolved. Okay? That's the other thing. So it was very hard to get any intimate details. And it was actually, thank you for asking the question, because then my agent came back to me and said, we need more pages on sex. I was like, well, how can I get more pages on sex when Lana is not going to tell me any of this stuff? She's like, well, we need it. So then I was like, well, okay, I have to sort of pad it out. What can I do? So I just sort of had to ask people, well, I'm sorry, they want more on sex. I don't know how to do it. So can you just tell me? And they all thought I was very, very strange. But they did. So I just managed to cobble a few things together. And And I think the only glimpses of what's really going on I see when, and so it's unspoken. It's you have to read between the lines. So one day we were talking about something, Lana and myself, and she said, she looked at me, and it was kind of a tender moment, and she said, "Remember, men are weak." That's what she said, exactly that, "Remember that." And I said, "Oh, okay, that's interesting." So, I mean, so you have to figure out what's been happening when she says that. What does that mean? Well, now I know that things are probably not going that well, but she's not going to tell me. And that's also in the book. It's that you only emerge when things are going well. So what I have learned to do in my 15 years of friendship with Shanghai women is that when I haven't seen a woman, a friend, and I know she's in Shanghai, she's living very close. It's not like she's, you know, flying around in London or in Europe, but she's actually around. And I haven't seen her for 3 years. I know that probably things are not going that well, but she's not going to tell me. When she shows up, she always looks great. So, I mean, I've learned to read between the lines because people aren't that upfront. They're very upfront about money and figures, finances. I was just telling some friends here, I was with, I came here with my Shanghai friend, and she said, "Oh, come, we're going to go and visit some friends," also a Shanghai friend. And we ended up at, the name shall be unmentioned, at some bizarre complex which made Las Vegas look tasteful. I mean, in some residential complex. And we went all the way up to the penthouse, where it was 5,000 square meters, and it was another Shanghai woman. And, you know, and they were all my age. And I was kind of blown away. I thought, this is kind of big. You know, this is kind of big. It's got a jacuzzi. It's got 9 decks. It's got sort of 6 sitting rooms. And, you know, it's got sort of maids coming out of all cracks and crevices. That's kind of interesting. But as soon as they said, "Oh, 200 million Hong Kong," you know, you don't even have to ask because they know you'd be interested. 200 million Hong Kong, I was like, and of course, between the Mandarin, because I can never convert the numbers correctly, it's like, liang bai, liang yi, or, you know, it's like, I'm like, wait, how many commas? Because the Chinese language has the commas in fours, right? So I can never convert correctly. I was like, I'm sorry, is that 20 million? 2,000? I'm 2 billion? I'm not really sure. And they sort of said it to me in English because they realized I couldn't convert. So they said 200 million. You know, but they knew, oh, but she bought it for 120. So she did really well. So, you know, this is kind of an everyday conversation. I mean, and there's no shame in it. You just ask. It's like, oh, how much was that handbag? Oh, well, in Shanghai, it's 50,000 RMB, but I got it in New York, and it was only $4,000. So it was great. I saved 48%. I mean, you know, the calculation is so fast and so precise, you know, that it's really incredible. But I mean, I think the other thing I would like to mention is that Lanlan is a businesswoman, and Shanghai is a city of commerce. It's actually a new city by Chinese standards. You know, it's not like Beijing or Xi'an or even Hangzhou or Suzhou. It's a new city. It's really a city that was not really in existence that the foreigners arrived. So it's a very brassy kind of city of that was built on commerce, and commerce coming from the foreigners. So I think the mentality in Shanghai is very, very different from Beijing or Suzhou or Hangzhou. So as you mentioned, you know, can you franchise and write about Guangdong Red Ladies? Probably not, because the Shanghai mentality is very, very specific. But, you know, I learned a lot of things, not just about how to deal with men. Not that, I mean, it was too late for me because I was married, unfortunately. But about business in China. So she would say, "Oh, well, I fired this guy." And I said, "Oh, why did you fire him?" It's like, "Oh, he was taking a kickback on a kickback." And, you know, like, I'm American, so I'm like, "Oh, I'm getting acclimated to the idea of kickbacks. I don't even know what that is." So I'm like, "Well, gosh, okay, I think I know what a kickback is. Kickback is, you know, when you sell, you know, when you give somebody business and you say, I want a percentage, right?" And she's like, "Yes." But I'm like, what is a kickback on a kickback? And she's like, "Well, kickback on a kickback is when you go to somebody and you say, you buy this for $100. Well, I'll give you a business that's worth $100 to you, but you give me $5. But the guy who's negotiating the kickback says, i.e. somebody in her company, she's fired, goes to the person and says, okay, I think I can get you 10 in kickback, but you kick back 2 to me. I mean, so I'm just trying to process this idea. It just seems so, so bizarre because it doesn't sort of pass muster with anything I've studied at Yale or even at, you know, anywhere. So I'm like, wow, that's very interesting. Then I said, well, how did you figure out that he was getting a kickback on a kickback? She said, oh, I tapped his phone. So I was like, oh, that's very interesting. And I said, well, you know, I said, you're selling these things, right? And so I asked her an ethical question. So I said, you're selling these things, okay? You're saying people are buying often, not because they need it or, you know, the institution they work for actually can benefit from it, but because they're getting a kickback. So I said, I mean, how do you feel about this? She's like, this is the way China works. If you don't get kickback, you cannot do business. And then I said, well, okay, let me ask you another way, because my father's a pastor, so I was born to be, I was raised to be a good girl. And I said, is there a business transaction that you will not do? And she said, yes. And I said, great, tell me. And she said, if they ask me to go to a train station, drop my cash in an envelope in a box, I will not do business with that person. So I thought, okay. You know, and I think in a way I had to appreciate her because I think we can be very spoiled and say we don't do this or we don't do that. This is not how it's done. But she grew up out of this business environment. She grew up out of an environment which was very specific. And I honor that.
Okay, well, I think we're a bit timed out there, folks. I'm sorry, no more time for questions. So all that remains to say thank you very much to Mina and inflict on her the usual FCC gift.
Thank you.
And say thank you very much.
It's even wrapped. There's a mystery about it. Okay, it's easy. It's a t-shirt. It may be something else.
Yeah.
I don't know.